It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. In 2016, a conversation about race in America seems to be about as difficult, as uncomfortable as it would have been 50 years ago. Why does race remain so difficult to talk about? Where should a conversation on race begin? Larry Davis, Dean and Founding Director of the University of Pittsburgh Center on Race and Social Problems, has put a lot of thought into that issue and addresses it in his new book, Why Are They Angry With Us? Essays on Race. He joins us now in studio. Larry Davis, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
And we'd like to have you join our conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email esspgh@wesa.fm. On Twitter at esspgh. What's the best way for a conversation on race to begin? What is the conversation about race that you would like to have? And what are the issues that we need to discuss openly when it comes to race? 412-246-2002 is the number to call. And Dr. Davis, correct me if I'm wrong in what I said in my opening, but are we any more comfortable talking about race in this country than we were 50 years ago?
Actually, I think we are. I think it's still very problematic, but 50 years ago, I don't think we talked about it hardly at all.
In the 60s?
In the 60s, we talked about, of course, the Civil Rights Movement. It died out largely after that. But I think today people talk about it more. I think they're uncomfortable with it. But I think because of the demographic changes of the country, some of the progress has been made, there's more contact between minority groups and majority group members than there were in the past historically. If you look at TV or you look at commercials or just even in an office place now, you know, there's more contact and there's more, and as a result, there's often more friction, more confrontations. So I think that's in part why we talk about it a little more.
I was watching a documentary recently on PBS about the Black Panthers. Mm-hmm. And what was interesting about that time was that there were so many emotions and feelings that people were starting to outwardly express that brought those emotions to a head and therefore led, in some cases, to conversations to the point where you would see, for example, leaders of the Black Panthers on Face the Nation. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you'd turn on the TV on Sunday morning and there's the conversation. At a time when there weren't, you know, cable network choices to make, you had those three channels, so you were likely to sit down and maybe listen to that conversation. It seems like we got to a point where we made a certain amount of progress, and then all of a sudden, we've stopped.
I think that was true. I think we've started again, though. What another program that was very popular, I think a lot about, was a program that was called The Hate That Hate Produced, which is sort of interesting. It had to do with the Nation of Islam in some respects. But there were a number of things but you're right, they have since that time largely gone away. But we're in it today, and we're in it today in part because of at least those two factors. One, that there's more contact between, in this case we can use blacks and whites, than there had been in the past, or Hispanics or non-white groups, and also social media. Social media has really been the causative agent. If you really go back, we think of Rodney King. I mean, it was a camera that did that, mm-hmm. you know. And the question that you and I were talking about before the show began, you know, what question that haunts me a lot, and that I've thought about maybe writing something, and it would be called something like, "How long has this been going on?" And what we have to realize that these conflicts and these very at time, deathly interactions just didn't come with the advent of the camera, that they've been going on, and the answer to that would clearly be forever. I mean, one can only imagine what life must have been like for African Americans in 1910, 1920, 30, 40, 50, before the cameras were rolling, that things are still very hostile towards them with the advent, with people knowing that there's a possibility that they're being videoed. And we also have to assume that even though we've had all these cases and all these incidents of really gross brutality going on, that we're not capturing them all. I would be curious what percent that are being captured even now. So when you think, if you could think back historically about it a little bit, this is really, you know, people sort of say, we'll get back together again. We were never together. This has been going on a long time.
Well, it's really, I think a lot of us think about it from time to time, and it's horrible to think about because you wonder how many people were wrongly convicted,
right.
How many people were executed
yeah.
who were innocent.
Yeah. Or just shot and beaten and just mistreated, you know.
Speaking of which, there's been a lot of that going on in Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
As columnist Tony Norman asked this week, is the system rigged in favor of white defendants? And the question has come up because among the instances that we've seen recently in this city is the brutal beating of Kevin Lockett, who said of his white assailants, only one of which is facing serious jail time, that if I was white and the people who attacked me were black, they would not be walking away. They would not be getting community service, as appears to be happening in this case for some of these defendants. What have you observed in Pittsburgh? You say this is a nationwide
thing. Yeah, it's a nationwide. Pittsburgh thinks it's unique, but it really isn't in that sense. You know, I think that's one thing that the social media has done, too, that, you know, I've studied race all my life. I've thought about it and done reports, written stuff. But I am amazed at the extent of racial bias being exhibited and practiced against African Americans in this country. I mean, I think even most of us being blacks thought, well, something happened in Alabama, something happened here. They were isolated events. But the camera has shown that it's all over the place. It's in Texas, it's in New York, it's in Missouri, it's in Pittsburgh. So this is a national phenomenon that I think that gave the birth to, you know, Black Lives Matter and things like that, that people, it was kind of like the TV show where people sort of said, you know, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take this anymore.
That was Network.
I kind of think that's what happened. I kind of think people, even like myself, who, you know, just didn't realize this is ridiculous. You know, one guy gets shot in the back. One week, one guy gets shot 16 times. The next week, someone else gets shot by walking unarmed. 33% of black people who were killed by police in 15 were unarmed. I mean, you know, some of them obviously probably were doing the wrong thing and you know, okay. But not all of them. I mean, you can't justify, and this is a conversation you and I were having earlier, you know. I'm a little curious what whites think about this. At some point, they must think, yeah, you know, some of these black people were probably doing the wrong thing, but they couldn't all be wrong, you know. And even in the face of visual evidence, we still are inclined to deny it and sort of said, well, they were thinking bad thoughts. So you know, it's a real issue. I think it's an issue for white America as well. I think it's a big issue for white America. I know Hillary spoke something about it on TV the other night. But it's an issue for white America that acknowledging it's never really acknowledged that it really had a part in it. It was always able to sort of say, you know, blacks are sort of doing this or you're not educated, you're not doing this. But today, I don't know how many thoughtful people can continue to do that.
You ask in your book, why are they angry with us? Essays on race. You know, the book is filled with personal anecdotes, and I want to get to some of those. But you ask the question in your book, if we were slaves, why are they angry with us?
Right.
They being white people.
Right.
So why indeed? Why do you suppose there is that anger, there was, and to some extent still is today?
There is. I mean, it's still there. You know, the question... This is my very first racial thought. I remember where I was, remember exactly what happened. I was about 7 years old, maybe six. But I was walking down the street and I asked myself a question. If we were slaves, us being blacks, why are they angry with us? I mean, why are the whites angry with us? It was a question that didn't make sense to me. I couldn't figure it out. I tabled it. I don't know whatever happened to it. But I finally found what for me is a satisfactory answer when we came in a doctoral program someplace. But it basically had to do with once we harm people, we have to hate them for it. You see, we can't harm good people. For example, just an example of this, I give it in the book a little bit. If someone says to you, we bought 15 million slaves to America, then you read it again another way and say, we bought 15 million men, women, and children to America. Different altogether, you know. In one case, they were debased people. It wasn't a big deal. We just brought some kind of not-so-worthy people anyway. So you can't hurt someone and think you're a good person. Something has to give. basically it was cognitive dissonance theory is what it came down to. That mean either if I come over there and take your tie, well, I either have to think you're a jerk and deserve me taking your tie, or I'm a jerk for taking it. And it's better for me to think that you're a jerk and I did the right thing by taking it. And that's so that's, if we try this to a massive level, so that's what happened. You know, you can't exploit. When you exploit, you have to give them both barrels. You have to exploit people, and you have to help hurt them for the exploitation you engaged in.
How much does guilt have to do with it? Does guilt felt by white people over having enslaved an entire race of people in this country for so many years play into that? That, you know, it kind of going along with what you're saying, that we have to hate somebody, and maybe it's just too hard to hate ourselves for what we've done. So,
there's some projection. You know, my girlfriend would ask me that. She sort of said, "Well, I wonder how they sleep." And I said, "They sleep just fine." I said, "It's because one of the things that people are able to do." We were talking about slavery,
white people.
Yeah, we're talking about slavery. How did they sleep during all this time? And they slept just fine. And they're able to sleep or able not to have a lot of guilt. I don't think whites have near as much guilt as people often say the whites running around all this guilt. I think if they had a lot of this guilt, they'd change their ways. I think that what happens is that they're able to justify it, that, well, they don't work as hard. Well, you know, they didn't take care of their kids. Well, you know, there's just some rationale as to why they are. It's their fault. I mean, you know, in the book I talk about that, why can't blacks be like immigrants? And it's why people often held blacks. Well, everyone else comes and has done it. Why don't you guys do it? Why you guys are sitting down on the job? But you have to have that to ward off the guilt. And those who don't buy those rationalizations do feel guilty. But I think that's a minority of people.
Let's take a phone call, 412-246-2002, to join our conversation with Dr. Larry Davis, Dean and Founding Director of the University of Pittsburgh Center on Race and Social Problems. Michael in Pittsburgh is on the line. Hi, Michael. Welcome.
Hello. Yes, you're talking about hating blacks, but then I see a lot of the same thing about blacks hating whites. And I don't hear nobody bringing up about the blacks hating whites. There's just as much prejudice on both sides.
Well, I'm guessing that's not the first time you've heard that.
No, that's a convenient argument. You know, you have to think about that, Mike, that basically blacks don't control very much in the country. Who's employed, who's not employed, who turns the lights on, union membership. I mean, whites have done to control those things. Blacks don't have. When someone says blacks have as much, it's like hitting a person or discriminating against a person or enslaving a person and then being angry with them for protesting. I mean, it's kind of sort of saying, well, now you're as much slave on, as much angry on your part. No, blacks should be angry. I mean, how they should handle that, we can talk about that some. But the fact that they, you know, been locked out, poor schools, poor jobs, people sort of say, guys sort of say, hey, we don't want them to have our jobs. And then the next sentence, we want to turn around and say, well, they're lazy. I mean, we keep them out of unions, we keep them out of some places to work. And then we say, well, hell, they don't want to work. Well, we can't have it both ways, but we have been having it both ways. So when someone says that to you, Mike, in the future, that, you know, is blacks are as race, blacks don't even have, there was an argument at one time, blacks really don't even have the means to engage in much racism. I mean, to engage in racism, you have to control something. You have to be able to deny the other population something. There's very few things that blacks can deny whites. Whites deny blacks a great deal.
And I've often thought, too, it has occurred to me, and I'm sure this occurred to others, that I wonder, in some respects, how it is that black people haven't reacted more harshly than they have.
They didn't do it in North Carolina. Was it North Carolina recently with the assassinations there?
Yes.
South Carolina. I get the Carolinas wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a case there. You know, you had King. You know, we haven't as a people, really. Black Americans have really tried to get in the system. I mean, they have tried to be part of America. They've tried to integrate in the houses, integrate in unions, integrate in jobs. They haven't tried. They didn't come to be excluded. But they haven't been met with gross resistance about being included as Americans. In fact, I dedicate this book to the millions of African Americans who were never able to be part of the American dream.
Which was a very profound statement. Let's go to Dave in Braddock Hills, who has a comment. Hi, Dave. Welcome. You're on with Dr. Larry Davis.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was looking at the situation with with the white community, and it's not about Black Lives Matter. It's about White Lives Matter. Because I was looking at the Trump crowd, and it seems like it's more about what they matter. It matters to them and to protect their values. The White Lives Matter, and it's about what they think is important. And so it's been like that for the past 300 years, ever since Washington. So it's got to protect the Constitution and their values. So it's really how do we bring them to the table, and how do we make their values include all people like Hispanics, African Americans, and everybody else. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Right. Well, thank you. That's a very reasonable question. You know, one of the things I think that has to happen with this is that, you know, America really is really under siege. I mean, you know, I used to have these fantasies of talking to a Klansman. In fact, I was on a show once with the Imperial Wizard years ago.
I'll ask you about what that was like. Go ahead with your point.
But they have to begin to see it in their interest. You know, people fundamentally, I used to have a course in one of it even questioned the idea of giving people, was there such a thing as philanthropy or something? Basically, things were done because it was in their self-interest. So the country has to begin to see this this white, non-white conflict is being against America's interests. You know, there's a world out there. I mean, things are going on out there. We need the workers. We need our own. We're wasting a lot of talent. We're wasting a lot of time. We're having a fight within our own group, with our own demise. So somehow we have to present a presentation to what our viewers, our adversaries at the moment, or whatever we want to call them, that this is ridiculous, and we really need to find a way to benefit all of us.
What was it like being on a talk show with the Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan?
Yeah, they always want to say to them, you know, they viewed poor people, and in this case he was talking about Black people, as, you know, taking the jobs, you know, or getting something you didn't deserve. And I always wanted to say to them, and I think I did say to him, you know, you're looking the wrong way. We don't have it. Poor people, Black people, Mexicans don't have it. You know, you have a double unemployment rate. We have double all these negative life perils, right? So the look up. That's where the money's at. That's where the action's at, and that's what needs to happen. Looking at populations below you in terms of trying to fend them off, saying, "Hey, you guys don't deserve anything." They don't have anything. They're looking. I want to say to the Klansmen, you're looking the wrong way. You need to look up. That's where the money is. That's where the action is. Blacks aren't keeping you from getting jobs. I mean, how could a minority of people take all the majority of jobs anyway? Mathematically, it wouldn't make sense.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Excuse me. We're talking with Dr. Larry Davis, who is Dean and Founding Director of the University of Pittsburgh Center on Race and Social Problems. His new book is Why Are They Angry With Us? Essays on Race. His focus is on trying to initiate conversations about race, and we'd like to hear from you about what's the best way for a conversation on race to begin. You can join our conversation at 412-246-2002. We'll get to more calls in a moment. Dr. Davis, this book is filled with personal anecdotes, the first of which you were too young to remember, occurs on a train you took from your mother and your siblings during the 1960s from your home in Michigan to your grandmother's home in Alabama. Share this story with us, if you would.
Well, it's a story I've told now on a number of occasions, but basically my mother, so you sort of sent me this question. There's a lot of data that goes in this. My mother was very fair. My mother was beyond just being light-skinned. My mom looked white for all practical purposes. In fact, I even asked her once, why didn't she just pass? Just be done with
it. What did she say to that?
She said that it never occurred to her. Because all of her relatives and everybody else was Black, and it has never occurred to her. But I asked her that. I did ask my mom that. I said, why don't you just pass, Mom? Why don't you just be white? And, you know. So anyway, she's on the train with three kids, Negro children at the time.
Including you.
Yeah. And the conductor comes along. You know, you had to change trains when you left out of Cincinnati going south. they segregated the trains when it went behind the cotton curtain, so to speak. Well, they asked my mom, said, okay, you know, it's nice to you with these little black kids, but you got to move, lady. You got to go up to the section for whites only. Well, my mom refused, and the conductor was, you know, a little miffed at first, and she said, you know, I'm fair-skinned, although I too am Negro, and these are my children. And he looked at her and punched the tickets and went on about his business, making sure that everyone was in their racially designated seats. So that was, but my story, you mentioned that I tell anecdotes, and I do, but I this isn't an autobiographical book at all. I told stories as a way to, I use myself as a vehicle to talk about race. That I use these examples of things that I knew happened and then tried to use the theories to explain why. I really wrote this book. There's a friend of mine, Shannon Murphy, not a friend of mine, actually. She's a PR person for the school. She is a friend of mine, too. But there's a section that says, a line that says, I wrote this book so it would be easy to read because I wanted people to read it. And that's exactly the case. I want people to. This was not written for Cornel West. This book is not. This book talks about fundamental racial things. You know, segregation. You know, just disparities in terms of prison a little bit. Or, you know, why does things work like they do? And for example, even the first question: why are they angry with us? People wonder about these questions. So you don't have to be an academic to read this. It's plain language. I sort of say something happened, and I try and explain it in a way and tell you why it works. I just don't tell you that happened. I try and explain to you with some theory as to why race works in America as it does. That's the real purpose of this book.
412-246-2002. Let's go to Aaron in Pittsburgh, and then we'll go to Shannon in Aetna. But first, Aaron, go ahead. You're on with Dr. Davis.
Hi. So my comment was that one of the basic problems of communication is that when white people and black people talk about racism, the word racism, they have different definitions for it. When a white person says racism, they're talking about one person, discriminating against a race of people. And it seems like when I'm white, so I don't want to speak for black people, but when black Americans talk about racism, they're talking about a system. Like, you know, the problem with Nazism wasn't that one guy hated Jews. It's that they set up a system that oppressed Jewish people. And it's the same thing with racism against black people. It's a system that oppresses black people.
Well, interesting comments.
Yeah, it's a comment. I agree with you completely that one case is doing individual and the other case is doing institutional. That, you know, sometimes people would say things to you like, well, you know, I wouldn't mind you moving into my neighborhood, but, you know, other people wouldn't do it. You know, the bank wouldn't loan money or something or other. And it isn't. And people who want to talk about just individual change are really sort of missing the point. Because it really is an institutional problem. I mean, it's banking, it's prison systems, it's judicial systems. It's how the country works that we need fundamental change.
Aaron, thank you for that call. Let's go to Shannon now in Aetna with a question. Hi, Shannon. You're on the air.
Hi. I am a student at Pitt, and I was just having a conversation with some of my classmates this morning about how we don't talk about race enough as professionals and as students. I don't think that it comes up enough unless you're, you know, directly studying, like, race and social problems. And, for example, like, I'm in the social work program, and I really don't think it comes up enough. So I was just wondering how, if Dr. Davis had any suggestions about how we could get the conversation going in our classrooms more.
Oh, wow. That's congratulations on being a student at Pitt in School of Social Work. And a great question, too. You know, I was having that conversation again with Shannon Murphy this morning, that at times I feel that I'm doing a better job of outreach outside of the university than I am inside the university. These are conversations that we need to have.
Why is that?
Well, part of it is that you can never be a prophet in your own land. It's part of it. People often want people from the outside whom they feel don't have a vested interest in it. And often it's not. I think, by the way, I think the School of Social Work, I think schools of social work nationally do a better job than most units in universities. Often they have the most diverse faculty, and often they have the most diverse students, as does the School of Social Work at Pitt. So we do a better job, I think. We do have a center on race and social problems, as you mentioned. We have a lecture series. You know, so we have a number of things that people do, but we could do a better job. You know, I agree with you completely. And we talk about that a little bit, you know, and I think some of the faculty use some of the videos and things we have. But we're not exempt, as I've said. We're really not exempt. And it's something that's that even our faculty who come from society, right?
Right.
And I think about some of the topics. They weren't trained in it like they might have been. So it's something we'll work on. We'll do a better job.
Let's take one last call from, I believe it's Rena. It might be Rena, but I hope it's Rena from Pittsburgh. Hi, Rena. How are you?
I am well.
Did I say your name right?
It is. Yes, you did.
Good.
I actually had a pretty interesting interaction. I'm a founder of a company, and when we brought up the issue of diversity, and I'm Arab American, so I definitely pass as a white woman, we brought up the issue of diversity within our workforce, and my co-founder, who is a British white male, really had a difficult time with the topic, and even the bringing up of the topic. And we ended up having the beginning of a series of conversations that have really proven to be quite useful. And I've spent a lot of time reading and thinking about this, but I do feel ultimately like there is a responsibility of white folks to grapple with this, to understand this, to be curious about this, and to talk to each other about it, rather than relying exclusively on interracial conversations around diversity. I feel strongly that there is a real responsibility just within the white community to understand what's going on and why it's going on, and to begin to have these conversations. And for me, it's been through personal relationship that I've really reached my own, like my mind has been expanded and I've learned.
Rena, I need to jump in because we're down to about 10 seconds.
But
here.
Buy 100 copies of Why Are They Angry With Us. Give them to all your friends and colleagues. It'll foster a great deal of conversation. I think you'll like the book.
Dr. Larry Davis is the author of Why Are They Angry With Us? Essays on Race. He's dean and founding director of the University of Pittsburgh Center on Race and Social Problems. Wish we had more time, but enjoyed the time that we did have, Dr. Davis. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us. Always a pleasure to be here.
I'm Paul Guggenheimer. See you tomorrow on Essential Pittsburgh.